Welcome back this morning to the second hour of this sermon. That's right. We're just going to pick up where we left off last week. And I'm sorry if you were not here for last week. You'll just have to catch up as we go because it was fully my intention last Sunday to include James 1, 6 through 8 in the commentary that I had started last week. In fact, I fully expected as the sermon unfolded that I would finish my comments in verse 5 and then just move right into verses 6 through 8, make a few comments about that and move on. But apparently in my verbosity, I was not able to do that. So verbosity means many words, okay? Because of my verbosity, I was not able to do that. And so this morning we're going to continue what we began last week. Now, I do think that it is a bit fortuitous that I could not, in fact, continue on. It gives me an opportunity to talk in much greater detail about a subject that's raised by James here. Now, the thought of verses 5 through 8 is one continuous thought, okay? It's not intended to be broken apart. In fact, it's a bit dangerous to do so. But I do think that the Lord in His wisdom has given to us an opportunity to consider another topic along with what we talked about last week, specifically the topic of wisdom. So we get a chance to talk in much greater detail this morning about the issue of doubt. But a caveat, and a very important caveat. I will be stepping out of verses 6 to 8 to talk about the subject in a general sense. I will be stepping out of verses 6 to 8 to talk about this concept of doubt in a more general sense. But James is not intending us to suppose that generality here. All right, let me say again what I mean. James is not suggesting in verses 6 to 8 that any doubt in the life of a follower of Jesus disqualifies him or her from salvation. Okay, I want to be clear about that right up front. Because I know there'll be some of you who walk out and go, all right, so I guess I can't be saved because I've got doubt. No, that's not what James is attempting to say here. The thought that James has here is specific. James is addressing specifically in verses 6 to 8 the doubt of asking God for wisdom in the face of suffering and then dismissing the answer. Okay? That's the specific area of doubt that he's referring to. Let me read 5 to 8 so you see the connection. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith. Okay, notice the key word there. Let him ask in faith without doubting or with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like the wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is double-minded and unstable. Okay, so he's not. These verses might look and you might say, oh, so doubt means I'm a double-minded, unstable man, therefore ... That's not where James is going. James has a very specific subject that he's talking about when it comes to doubt here, okay? So as I said, although I'm going to be stepping out of verses 6 to 8 and talking about the subject of doubt in a general sense, that's not James's intention here, okay? So although doubt is not the primary subject of verse 6 to 8, I think we should discuss the concept. I think it's important because it is the universal human and Christian experience. Doubt is the human and Christian experience. Everyone doubts. And if you come to me and say, I don't have any doubts, what am I going to say to you? I doubt it. And like wisdom, it cries out for definition and teaching in the church. Last week, we spent the whole sermon talking about what wisdom is. This week, it's important that we talk about doubt. But doubt, unlike wisdom, is actually an extremely complex subject. It actually is. It's a very complex subject. And so I'm very reticent about what I'm about to say, because the fact of the matter is that I'm going to have to talk about doubt in very technical terms. I'm going to talk about what it means in very technical terms. We might call it forensic terms. But I'm hoping that by the time we get to the end, Lord willing, that we'll have made an application of it in a way that you'll actually be able to walk out of here and say, okay, I understand. That's why I said to the elders this morning, I really don't want to preach this sermon, because it's difficult to get across. It's a concept that we think we know what it means, but we don't very often. And that's why it screams, cries out for us to talk about it. So I think it was fortuitous for the Lord to give us another week on verses 5 to 8 in order to consider this topic. Okay, the word itself, doubt, comes from a Greek word, diakrino. Listen carefully to the lexical definition of this word, okay? Here's where we're going to start really getting technical. The word originally meant, when it was originally penned in the lexicon, simply this: to evaluate carefully, to make distinction, to distinguish or discern this versus this. That's what diakrino means. It means to evaluate. It means to make distinction. Now, all of that is in the positive sense of the word, the positive sense of make this distinction versus this distinction. I don't know about this. I'm going to think about this. I'm going to think about this. Okay, that's the original idea in the positive sense. The word, however, in this instance, as well as many others in the New Testament, is actually used in a more negative mood. Okay, so you flip it over, and on the other side you have to dispute, to critique, to criticize, or to pass judgment. Now, notice, both of those seem to have the idea of comparing this to this. This versus this. On the positive side, make a decision between the two. On the negative side, reject one or the other. Okay, that's the basic idea of diakrino. Now, in the Bible, the word is used in a number of different ways, and there's dozens of ways it's used, but I'm just going to refer to a few. First, it means to waver in regards to what is known, as Paul says in Romans 4:20. Doubting is to waver in regards to what is known. Which is it, this or this? See the idea? Discerning one position to another and then wavering. Which one? Which one? Which one? Okay? In Acts chapter 10, verse 20, it's used in the sense of to hesitate to act based on something one knows. To hesitate to act based on something one knows. In another case, it can mean not only to waver and to hesitate, but to examine and reject is another way. Now, it's difficult to interpret. It's difficult to interpret. But fundamentally, it's to interpret negatively a bit of information. To interpret negatively a bit of information. Now, as I said, it's a difficult word to define because of its wide semantic domain, how it's used in Scripture. It's used in so many different ways. The fact is that it's very hard for us to get a specific, individual, clear, crystal definition of how the word works. And then secondly, and here's where the real problem is that there's a very nebulous sense of how we use it every day. There's a very nebulous sense of how we use this word. We throw it around, but I don't think that we're very consistent in how we use it very often. For example, let me ask two questions. Is doubt the same thing as disbelief? And you're thinking, well, sometimes it seems like it and sometimes it's not. I don't know. Is doubt the opposite of faith, for example? You notice this is a difficult word to get your hands around, right? Because of its negative connotation. Okay. So here's what I want to put before you first, a thesis. My thesis is this, and I've spent the whole week hammering this out. Here's what I think. I think that faith and doubt are mirrors of one another. Mirrors of one another. You know what a mirror is, right? An image, but reversed. Looks the same and yet in reverse. Okay? Faith and doubt are mirrors of one another. They are not opposites of one another. They're not opposites of one another. The mistake I think many people make is to assume that they are the opposite of one another. Thus, if you have doubt, you don't have faith. No, not necessarily. All right? Faith and doubt begin in the same place, but move in different directions, quote unquote, based on one's inclination. Both faith and doubt start from the same place, but move in different directions. Imagine a line going in opposite directions, right? Remember back in, was it algebra or geometry? Where you had a number line, right? Which one is it? I never remember. Okay, both? Okay. You have a central point, zero, right? Negative numbers go that way, positive numbers go that way. Okay, so this is the idea of faith and doubt. They start from zero. They both start from the same place. Okay, it's important to remember this. Now, what is that same place? What is that zero mark in the middle? Simply put, the zero mark in the middle is a bit of information. Very simply, a bit of information. Some bit of knowledge. Something that is made known to us. In the sense, it's simply something we come to know. Now, biblically, the idea is from Revelation, what God has revealed. Biblically, doubt and faith both start from the position of some sort of revelation. That which is given to us is no. But both start from there, from a bit of knowledge. I know this, therefore, I go in this direction or I go in this direction. So, let's put it this way. Faith accepts the possibility that the information, the bit of information that we receive, whatever it is true or most likely true, and embraces its ramifications. Doubt also accepts the possibility that the bit of information is true, but dismisses its ramification because the individual is inclined away. You'll notice they both start from the same place. Doubt and faith both start with some bit of information, some revelation or understanding or knowledge of some sort that is given to us that we come to, and we either believe it and trust in it or we doubt. But we both start in the same place. It's important for us to keep that distinction, which is why I am convinced that disbelief is different from doubt. They're not the same thing. Disbelief simply denies entirely that the bit of information is true. Disbelief simply says that particular bit of information that I've received ain't true. Therefore, I'm not going that way and I'm not going that way. I'm going nowhere because that information is simply untrue. That's disbelief. That's not doubt, okay? Doubt is accepting the possibility that that information may be true, but is inclined away from it. Let me use what I think is the best example in Scripture. Who is often called the doubter? Thomas, right? John chapter 20, okay? Now, I am convinced absolutely that Thomas was not a doubter. I look at Thomas, and I don't see him as a doubter at all. I see him as one who disbelieves. You read the text in John 20, he does not leave open the possibility that the disciples who told him they had seen Jesus rise from the dead might have been true. He just simply says, I don't believe it, and I won't believe it until I actually get to put my fingers in his hands and touch his side. Otherwise, I simply don't believe it. Did he have any doubt? Nope. In fact, it's quite the opposite. He was an undoubter. He was a disbeliever. He became a believer when Jesus showed up and showed him his hands and his side. And then he believed because he had seen the evidence of it. He was not a doubter at all. He was a disbeliever until he could prove the matter fully. Now, having set that before you, let's move to the next step, which is this. Look, the reality is that faith and doubt, whichever way you go when it comes to some bit of information, begins from the reality that human beings cannot have perfect knowledge. The sad reality of living as human beings, notice I didn't say fallen human beings, I said human beings, is that we are finite creatures that cannot possibly know all there is to know, nor know it perfectly. We cannot know all that there is to know in a perfect way. All knowledge that comes to us is subject to interpretation. It comes in through your eyes and your ears and your other senses. You receive information, however it comes to you, but it's got to pass through the lens of you before you can understand it. And all of the different kinds of things that affect your ability to interpret are all around you all the time. Your educational level, your experiences, all that you have experienced in your life, your presuppositions, those inclinations that you naturally have to believe or disbelieve certain things, your personality, your worldview, how you see everything around you, your circumstances at the moment, how you're feeling even at this particular moment, all affects how a bit of information shows up in your mind and what you do with it. All of that. And I've just given you the tip of the iceberg of the various kinds of things that affect the way that you think. There's 1,000 more things that determine how you take in a bit of information and how you process it. There's myriads of things that affect a piece of information coming out of the world through your senses and into your brain. Only God has perfect knowledge. He has perfect knowledge inherently because He's God, but He also has perfect knowledge because He is not bound by those same kinds of creaturely realities. He doesn't have a set of interpretations in front of him because he's God. He's not a creature. He's not a finite being with a brain that has to somehow figure this stuff out. He is perfect and has perfect knowledge. All human knowledge is imperfect. Period. Everything you know, but you're not really sure you know it. And it may not be right. Oh, you may think it's right, and you may insist that it's right, but it may not be right. Have you ever gotten into a situation where someone called it to your attention that you're wrong about something, and you actually had to admit it? Someone's shaking his head back there. I doubt it. We must evaluate all information that comes to us to determine if and how it will affect us. We have to evaluate every bit of information that comes to us to determine if and how it will affect us. And we make those decisions. And by the way, you are making those decisions millions of times a day and you don't even realize it. You don't even realize it. So let's deal with one. Let me just give you one exemplar of information. Let's see what we do with it, okay? The Apostle Paul tells us in Romans chapter 10, verse 13, the following statement. Everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. That's a bit of information, isn't it? Seems like a command and also a fact. Also looks like a promise. Everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. Now, there are many, of course, in the world who will simply disbelieve it. Right? What? Are you kidding me? Oh, I just have to call on God and He'll save me? Nah, I don't believe that. I believe something else. So there's a lot of people that don't doubt this phrase. They just simply disbelieve it. I don't have anything to do with it. They utterly deny that one could be saved simply by calling upon the name of the Lord, whatever that means. Right? They don't really care. They don't really know. Therefore, they just leave it at that. But the reality is that this is a particular statement which then you take as a bit of information, and now you have to decide which direction you're going to go. Are you going to believe that, or are you going to doubt it? Now, the statement itself, if you remember from Romans chapter 10, is actually a condensed form of two expectations that are established earlier in the same chapter. Paul had written just a few sentences earlier two facts. The first of those is, those who are saved must confess with their mouth that Jesus is Lord. And secondly, those who are saved must believe in their heart that God raised Jesus from the dead. Okay? So this idea of calling upon the name of the Lord is actually based on two other kinds of things. Number one, that we confess with our mouth that Jesus is Lord and we believe in our heart that God raised Him from the dead. So, the statement, all who call upon the name of the Lord, must be evaluated by us in light of its basis in fact. And the fact is what? Did this Jesus actually rise from the dead. You see it? If you're going to say, on the one hand, all who call upon the name of the Lord, and Paul has described what that means in two sides, then the obvious question we must ask is, did this Jesus really, in fact, rise from the dead? And if he did, what are the ramifications of that truth? Now, you know this as well as I do, that the entirety of the Christian religion is built upon the supposition that Jesus rose from the dead, right? The entirety of the Christian faith is built upon this very foundational bedrock reality. Did this Jesus, this carpenter from Nazareth who was crucified by Pilate, actually walk out of a tomb alive, bodily, on a Sunday morning? That is a foundational truth. Look, I've said it many times at Easter, I'll say it again. If Jesus did not walk out of that tomb on that Sunday morning, then there would be no knowledge of this Jesus in the world today. None of you would know his name. We wouldn't be measuring our calendars from his birth. We would have no knowledge of him. He would be, at best, a historical footnote in a history book languishing and collecting dust on a library shelf. That would be the entirety of the Christian religion if he didn't walk out of that tomb. Period. So his resurrection from the dead, his literal bodily resurrection, becomes the foundation of the entire Christian religion. But here's the problem. None of us can have perfect knowledge of that event, can we? How many of you were there on that Sunday morning? Anyone? How many of you have the videotape that Mary Magdalene took? Videotape. Man, I really just aged myself, didn't I? How many of you have the digital video record of that particular event? Anybody? Oh, and by the way, if you do, are you sure it hasn't been doctored in some way? See, how many of us really absolutely, unequivocally can prove scientifically, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Jesus walked out of the tomb? We can't, can we? The best that we can do is hear someone say it, hear others say it, have a history of the church down through 2,000 years of time, which seems to confirm the idea, and then we have to make a choice. We are asked to take that bit of information and decide what we will do with it, you see? Because we cannot have perfect knowledge, all we can do is take that bit of information and decide what we will do with it. Now, here's what's fascinating. When Jesus showed up, after Thomas had said, I won't believe until I see, Jesus shows up, right? And says, here's my hands, go ahead, touch, here's my side, go ahead and touch. Thomas doesn't. I think he realizes at that moment, I don't need to. But you will notice that following that, Jesus does not castigate Thomas for his empiricism. He doesn't. He doesn't say to him, you wicked man that you need to see in order to believe. No, what does he say? He says, you have believed, and that's good. But he says, blessed are those who do not see and yet still believe. What is he saying? He's saying there are going to be generations of people from this point forward, millions upon millions of people who are going to be confronted with that truth. I, Jesus, walked out of a tomb on that Sunday morning, but none of them were there, and so they're all going to have to take that bit of information and decide for themselves what they're going to do with it. They're going to decide. Thus, faith and doubt move in opposite directions from the same point. All of us are asked to look at that bit of information. Christ walked out of a tomb on a Sunday morning. We're going to have to decide what we're going to do about it. Faith decides that the information is more likely to be true. Again, can't be proved, but more likely to be true, and move in that direction, whereas doubt decides it is less likely to be true and moves in that direction. But here's what I want you to really be careful to recognize. Faith and doubt fundamentally deal with the issue of the ramifications of what we know. Okay? Think about that for a second while I take a sip here. Faith and doubt fundamentally deal with the issue of the ramifications of what we know. It's not the bit of information itself that fundamentally decides faith and doubt. It's the ramifications of that information that decides faith and doubt. You say, well, what are you talking about? Okay. Let's think for a moment about Jesus walking out of a tomb. All right? Let's think about the fact that this crowd, let's think about the bit of information. I'm not going to call it a fact. Let's call it a bit of information that all of us are forced to deal with. This Jesus walked out of a tomb. What are the ramifications of that? What are the ramifications of that? Didn't he say he was going to do that? Didn't he say that? A number of times. You can't read the gospel accounts, particularly the fourth gospel, without coming to the realization that this Jesus not only predicted he was walked out of the tomb, but worked his way in that direction towards being crucified so that he could walk out of a tomb. It's the whole point of the fourth gospel, in fact, I would argue. All of the signs that he did were to point to this one thing that would happen, particularly calling Lazarus forth out of a tomb, right? Okay, so the bottom line is, the ramification is that if this Jesus walked out of that tomb and had predicted to do so, what does that mean about the rest of what he said? What does that mean about the rest of what he said? I mean, look, can you imagine somebody today standing in front of the world and saying, kill me and I'll come back to life after 3 days? You'd lock him up, wouldn't you? That's a lot of chutzpah. Nobody's going to do that. But he did. He had the audacity to actually stand in front of the world and say, kill me, and I will rise after 3 days. Remember how fascinating this is to remember, what was the accusation that was made against him in front of the Sanhedrin? When he was brought before the Sanhedrin on the night that he was arrested, what did they do to accuse him and then ultimately convict him? They brought people in who quoted him, didn't they? We heard this man say, tear down the temple, after 3 days I'll rebuild it, right? Didn't they come and say that? That was what ultimately decided whether they're going to get rid of him or not, because he was a threat to their livelihood in the temple. By the way, the chief priests are the primary antagonists in this whole equation. I want you to keep that in mind. The fact of the matter is, they were terrified of what this Jesus would do about the temple, but he wasn't talking about his temple, and even John notes that in his gospel account. He wasn't talking about the temple, he was talking about himself. So what is he doing? He's standing in front of the world before he's crucified and say, listen, I am going to rise from the dead. And then he does. What does that say about all the other things that he said? Or more particularly, what does that say about who he was? Not just about what he said, but about who he was. Because, again, what human being is going to stand up and say, kill me and I'll rise again in 3 days? You see, what everything else that he said is his nature as the Son of God, or the ramifications are the nature of his Son of God, his teachings, his authority over all things, the entirety of the message that came from him in the gospel, the entire flow of theology, and dare I even say the entirety of human history, is built on one fact in time, which was predicted by the same man. You see it? All of human history is based on this reality. I remember years ago when we were at Calvary, there was a woman who came to one of our evening Bible studies that we were doing. We were doing a series on apologetics, and so she came. She was invited by one of the members of the church, and she came, and she had, oh, I think I would basically say that her spiritual background was muddied. She had been a Jehovah's Witness for a while. She had dabbled in Catholicism for a while, some Eastern spirituality. She had been agnostic for a while. She was a mess spiritually. She had no idea of anything. But she came to the church, and she sat for 2 Sunday nights. And on the second Sunday night, after the class was over, she wanted to talk with me. So we sat down and we talked, and I tried to convince her that, of the gospel, and she was struggling with it. And so finally I got exasperated with her, and I said, okay, here's what I want you to do. Go home, read the Gospel of John, and tell me this when you come back next week. Based on your reading of the Gospel of John, Jesus is either one of two things. He's either Lord of your life or he's a lunatic. You decide. You tell me. He's either Lord or lunatic, because nobody stands around and claims, I'm going to rise from the dead after 3 days. He's either Lord or lunatic. She came back the next week. She saw him as Lord. She was converted, baptized, joined the church, and has been a faithful follower of Christ ever since, because she made a choice about a bit of information that she had seen. You see, accepting that Jesus rose from the dead implies the ramification that he is Lord. That's why Paul puts it the way that he does. If you will confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord, it comes from your belief that he rose from the dead. Those two things are not separate. They're the same thing. To call upon the name of the Lord is to accept that he rose from the dead and that his resurrection proves his position as Lord, with the ramification that he is Lord of me. Not just Lord in a general sense, because there's no such thing. Lord in a specific sense. Thus, our faith is to see a bit of knowledge, a bit of information as true, although it cannot be proved, and to embrace its ramifications. It's not to embrace just the fact, it's to embrace its ramifications. I could do this in the area of mathematics, technically. I'm no mathematician. But I could say, listen, what are the ramifications of the following statement? 2 + 2 = 4. The entirety of mathematical systems, from simple arithmetic all the way to quantum mechanics, are built upon that fact. There's structure and order in math that leads all the way out from there. Same thing is true here. One little bit of information. This Jesus walked out of a tomb. Expands out from that to all that he said, and then all that the apostles said, and then all the church has taught, and then expanding all the way forward and backward in history to the decree of God in the past, to the consummation of the kingdom in the future. All of it is built upon one simple reality: that Christ walked out of a tomb alive. Which is why Paul makes it that simple in Romans chapter 10. This is what it means to be saved. There's a fundamental fact. Now, our friend Mr. Stanley in Atlanta would have us to believe that that's the only thing you need to believe. Well, he couldn't be more wrong, because the ramifications begin to multiply out from there, moving backwards in time, back into the Old Testament, and you simply cannot understand the resurrection of Jesus without understanding all that follows from it in the prophecies that came and the decree in eternity past. But you will notice it's about the ramifications. Faith is to see a bit of knowledge is true and to embrace its ramifications. Doubt is to dismiss or diminish those ramifications due to some sort of lack of proof. Now, in case you haven't figured it out yet, the entirety of the letter we're in, the entirety of the letter of James, is to convince his readers of this. Genuine faith doesn't just believe the information. Genuine faith embraces the ramifications of that information in all of life. You see it? You don't just believe a few facts. No. Believing those facts leads to certain ramifications. There's a domino effect that falls as a result of believing that information. If this Jesus rose from the dead, then what follows? You see. What faith does is says, I believe that information to be true, therefore I'm going to move forward to the ramifications. Doubt says, I'm not sure of that information. It's possible, but I'm not sure, and I'm moving away from the ramifications of that truth. You see? That's the distinction between faith. That which is why I said this is such a very difficult thing to preach. It's very hard to get that idea in our mind. We believe the information in a sense, but what do we do with it? What are the ramifications of that truth? That's where doubt lies. Doubt doesn't lie in just believing the information. Doubt lies in what we do with it. Listen, I have known many people in my life who would stand in front of the world and pronounce the truths of the creed. More than happy to recite the Apostles' Creed. More than happy to do so. My father could quote to you the Apostles' Creed without any trouble at all. He knew every bit of it. He believed every single word that was written there. Yes, he believed there was one God, the creator of heaven and earth. He believed that Jesus Christ was born of a virgin, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was died, was sinless. He believed in this church and the Spirit and all the other ramifications of the Apostles' Creed. But the ramifications of those truths never hit home. And he went to his grave with no faith in Christ. He knew the truths, but it didn't matter. The ramifications of the truths are what counts. So doubt is created and faith is diminished by one simple thing. You ready for this? You ready? Here it is. Go back to the starting point. Where do faith and doubt begin? They begin in the same place. A bit of information. How do you get doubt? Misinformation. How do you create doubt? You change the facts on the ground, which by implication changes the ramifications with it. You see, it is the work of the father of lies, notice his title, the father of lies, misinformation, to insert false information into your minds with ramifications then that are contrary to the ramifications of truth. Let's go back to my example, Romans 10. Satan says the following into your head. You may have called upon the name of the Lord to be saved, but your sinfulness clearly implies you cannot be saved. How many of you have ever struggled with that? Don't raise your hand. I would raise mine. I would empathize with that very much. And I've had many who have come to me with that exact thought. Yes, I believe Jesus walked out of a tomb. I believe that he died for me. I've called upon his name. But I've looked at my own life and I see the sinfulness in my life and I wonder, can I really be saved? Notice what the father of lies is doing. He's inserting into your mind a doubt related to your security based on the lie that immediate behavior is what determines your standing before God. Let me say that again. It is the father of lies who puts into your mind, into your heart, that your immediate behavior is what ultimately determines your standing before God. It is a lie. But it's designed to put doubt, because now you have a new piece of information, right? The other piece of information was, I believe this Jesus walked out of a tomb. But the new information that seems to pile up on top of it, it sits over the top of it, is, but I'm a sinner. I am a gross sinner. I have done many wicked things. And therefore, I could call upon the name of the Lord, but it won't matter. That is a lie. See, the devil knows that he can't change the fundamental truths of the faith. He knows he can't change the fundamental truths of the faith, that this Jesus walked out of a tomb. He can't change that. He can't change any of the ramifications related to that fact, that this Christ walked. He can't change any of that. He certainly cannot change the decree of God as to who is saved and who is not, and how that salvation comes. He can't change any of that. He knows that. He is impotent before the gospel of Jesus Christ. So what is he going to do? He just slips in some more information that is false, a little bit of a lie that's designed to twist what God has said so that you begin to think of the ramifications of that more than the ramifications of the information that comes from God. I could spend the next 15 minutes, I'm not going to, but I could spend the next 15 minutes showing you how Eve fell for that. She did, didn't she? Has God really said? So what do we do? What do we do when that doubt comes? When that moment of wondering, am I really saved? Have I really called upon the name of the Lord and saved me? What do we do? And the answer to it is simple and yet extraordinarily far from our minds very often, okay? And it's this. We simply reassess the original or fundamental revelation and its ramifications. Here's what I say. Here's what I say to myself. When I have sinned against the Lord, and once again I find myself in that situation, standing before God in heaven, repenting, and then wondering, that moment, oh, maybe I'm not really saved. What do? I run back to that most fundamental truth, and I say, you, Lord, walked out of a tomb on a Sunday morning, and you have said to all who will believe that and call upon your name, they will be saved. I'm taking you at your word. This other junk is a lie. I'm taking that fundamental truth at the core. You see it? We go back to what is foundational and fundamental. Our faith is not built on shifting sand. Our faith is built upon the rock of a reality that this Christ walked out of a tomb, and if he rose from the dead, if he did, then everything else he said must be true, and he said that all who believe that he rose will be saved. Doubt is created by the devil inserting misinformation that causes us to reevaluate other truths. Moment by moment, day by day. So doubt is created and faith is dismissed by misinformation. So let's flip that coin over and look at the other side. Doubt is diminished and faith is grown by the advancement of true knowledge. True knowledge. There are most today in the church, for example, if I might use an example, the vast majority of people today who go to church, who are sitting in the church even now, do not believe that there is a divine decree established over all things. And I know that's true. And you know why I know that's true? You know how I know that's true? It's not I polled every person, but because I was there. Because for years, decades, in fact, I went to a typical Baptist church and never knew that there was anything like a divine decree. No, in fact, for most evangelicals, it's simply the idea that all of your sufferings, my friend, are simply random events that occur in this world. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be, will be. And so the person comes to the pastor's office, he's got troubles in his life, and the pastor has no choice but to say to him, well, I'm sorry that you're experiencing that, and I really wish I had an answer for you, but all I can tell you is that, you know, everything is just random in this world, so I hope you make it through it, and I'll be here for you. I don't know what that means, but I'll be here for you as you go through it. And then the person leaves his office, and the pastor closes his door and goes, whew, man, I'm glad that's not happening to me. There's no purpose in suffering, according to modern evangelical theology. There's no purpose in suffering. It's simply random. It's not a part of any sort of divine plan. But notice this. It is a twisting by the devil to diminish true faith. I mean, after all, how can anything be true if there's purposeless suffering in the world? What's the question that every atheist wants to ask? Well, you people claim that there's a God, but then there's all this suffering out there. Why would God allow all that kind of suffering? Because I know I'm the master of this world, and I'm the master of my own destiny, so I don't know what God you got, because the only God I've got is me. Purposeless, random suffering with no answer is a lie spun from the depths of hell, designed to get your mind off the truth and onto a falsity. Thus, you embrace the ramifications of the falsity. We call that doubt. The solution, according to the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 4, is for God to provide teachers to advance our understanding of all that God has revealed. You see it? In the book of Ephesians, he starts the book with the divine decree in Ephesians 1, right? spends a great deal of time talking about there's a decree and we've been predestined into it as sons and daughters. The Spirit has come, all these kinds of things. He gets to chapter 4 and he says, you want to know how that's true? God has given to the church teachers to teach that to you. And the goal of the teachers is to teach you not only what the truths are, but what the ramifications of those truths are, that you might have faith, not doubt. You see it? The church isn't designed to be a place where we go for entertainment. The church is designed to be a place to fill your hearts and minds with the knowledge that comes to us from the Scriptures in order that you might know more and more about this God. Thus, because you have more and more information that you see is true, the result of that is greater faith. The connection between knowledge and faith and a lack of knowledge and doubt is exact. Maturity comes through knowledge. The more we understand the revelation given to us by God, the more our doubts will flee and our faith will grow. You see that? What's the answer to our doubts? Know more of what this God has said. Know more of what this God has said. Not only did that Jesus walk out of a tomb, but there are 1,000,000,000 other ramifications to that reality. What are they? What are they? Can you list them? Can you name them? Do you know what they are? That's the goal. It is the inclination of our heart that needs to be addressed by the Spirit of God. It is the inclination of the heart that needs to be addressed by the Spirit of God. Faith and doubt will always coexist in the heart of a believer. Always. But God has promised to hold fast, even in the face of doubt, those who seek to know His Word more and better. I love the statement of the centurion, Mark 9:24. I believe, help my unbelief. That is the Christian life. We have information. We have to decide what to do with it. We have to decide what the ramifications of that are. And yes, there will be times we'll look at the information and we'll not be sure. So what do we need? What's the cure? The cure is for us to grow up in our understanding of these things. Doubts will then be converted to faith as we think of the ramifications of these realities in our lives. Or more specifically, the ramifications of what it is that Christ has accomplished. Now, back to James 6:8. In verse 5, you remember that James says that those who seek the wisdom of God will find it. Let him ask God. You need wisdom? You want to know why you're suffering? You want to know why you're struggling? You want to know why your life is filled with problems? Okay, ask God and He will give you an answer. He will give you an answer. But, and this is what verse 6 and 8 are going to say, you must believe that He is willing to give such insight and that the answer He gives is fully sufficient for you. Ouch. We talked last week about the fact that wisdom is the proper application of knowledge. Take knowledge, apply it, okay? I just did about a 50-minute soliloquy on that idea again from a different perspective. Wisdom, take the knowledge, apply it properly, okay? That's what wisdom is, all right? Doubt in this context then, remember, doubt in this context is not doubt about our salvation or eternal security, but doubt about whether God can or will give us insight into any particular trial of life. You having a problem in your life? Some struggle? Some pain of some sort? Something you're not sure exactly how to explain? Go to the Lord and ask Him. Go to the Lord and ask Him. And here's the question. Will He answer? Will He answer? And is His answer sufficient? Do we believe Him? Now, James insists that those who seek wisdom from God must come to Him believing that He is willing to give such insights. Notice, it isn't about whether He can give such insights. It's about whether He's willing to give such insights. Many of us are, well, I'm not going to ask God. He's not going to tell me. I mean, the secret things belong to God, right? And so, therefore, all the suffering that I have in my life, it's random. No, no, no. We must believe that if we go to the Lord, He is willing to give us an answer. But we must also be willing to accept that those insights are sufficient for us. Because as I pointed out last week, God cannot give you the fullness of understanding of your situation. If God were to reveal to you everything that went into the particular reason why you're suffering, your head would fall off. You couldn't accept all the information. There is simply too much in it. The grand plan of God started in eternity past with Adam, and it's working its way through you. You just happen to be one person along a massive spectrum of issues dating all the way back to the prehistory of the world. If God were to give you all that, you'd never be able to figure it out. But he does give us some insight from his word. And specifically, he gives us the insight that we need. Now, I'm convinced that in verses 6 to 8, what James is doing is using hyperbole. You know what hyperbole is, right? You say something very grandly in order to make a point. Okay? Very, very grandly. Right? He's saying, let him ask in faith with no doubting. For, listen, the one who doubts is like the one who's blown away by the sea. He's using hyperbole in order to make a point. When he uses wave of the sea, he's talking about a person who fails to understand from God because they're constantly in motion, flitting from thing to thing and thing, never really settled any place they're at. And I'm going to go here, I'm going to go there. I'm going to get information over here, I'm going to get information over there. And they never stop long enough for God to go, okay, can I talk now? The double-minded man, James argues, is the person who knows on the one hand that God is the true source of insight, but on the other is either unwilling to seek understanding from God or refuses to accept the truth given. Yeah. I know that's what God's really doing, but that's not the answer I want. I want a better answer than that. That's the double-minded man. So I'm convinced that James uses very harsh language here to warn his readers. And here's the warning. Do not ignore the knowledge already given by God. Do not dismiss the application that God has provided in the knowledge he's already given you. Worst case scenarios, God may only say, well, you know what? I'm glorifying myself through your pain. Isn't that kind of what he said to Job? No, isn't that exactly what he said to Job? You listen to all of Job's friends for as long as you can take it. And then you get to the end of the book and God shows up in the whirlwind and says to Job, listen, yeah, you're suffering. I took away everything. You know what? Here's why I'm doing it. Shut up. I'm not telling you. Fundamentally, that's the book. It's easy to preach. Were you there when I laid the foundation of the world? Nope. Do you have any idea how the Leviathan's tail works? Nope. So shut up. Just know that I am God. Just know that I am the one who is accomplishing what it is that needs to be done. You see, what we need in the face of our sufferings is wisdom. We need to seek understanding from God himself as to why we are suffering. And James promises us that if we will go to the Lord, truly seeking such wisdom, that's the key here in verses 6 to 8, truly seeking such wisdom, he will provide it insofar as that it aligns with his eternal will or what he can reveal to us. Listen, the Bible is not opaque on this subject. It's very transparent, very clear. You want to know why they're suffering in the world? The scriptures are loaded with the reasons why. What God reveals to us will be sufficient through us through faith. Paul writes it this way in 1 Corinthians 2. You've heard these words 1,000 times. Yet amongst the mature, we do impart wisdom. To whom? The mature! Although it's not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are doomed to pass away. But we impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. Really? There's a purpose for it. None of the rulers of this age understood it. For if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. They wouldn't have strung enough if they have understood even a bit of this, but they didn't. But as it is written, no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined what God has prepared for those who love These things God has revealed to us through the Spirit. The most fundamental fact that God has revealed in all things is that He is doing something beyond your imagination. You have no idea. None. What James is saying is, listen, take that bit of information and do something well with it. You can do two things with that bit of information. You can either say, well, I'm not so sure about that. My circumstances are such that I'm not really sure that's the case. Now notice what the father of lies is doing, whispering into your ear. Hey, God may not be doing good things in your life. Has God really said? And so what comes is doubt. Or what you can do is go back to the most fundamental fact. The most fundamental fact is this Christ has been raised from the dead. And that resurrection of this Jesus is part of the greatest glory story ever written on this planet. And I've been included in it because I have called upon the name of this one who has been raised. You see, ultimately, my friends, our trials are a part of the eternal decree of God to glorify Himself through a people that He lovingly grooms into the image of His Son to adopt as His own children. Our trials are part of the eternal decree of God to glorify Himself through a people that He lovingly grooms into the image of His Son to adopt as His own children. Do you understand that? Do you believe it? Fundamentally, that's the question that's put to you. Do you believe that? Or are you still wandering around believing like the rest of the world does that, well, I don't really know why these things are happening to me. Nobody knows why these things are happening to me, but I'm just going to grit my teeth and bear it. Do not let the devil whisper in your ear that which is false in order to move you in the wrong direction. Don't let that happen. He's going to want to convince you that you don't need to know any more about the Word of God. You don't need to know. You know enough. You know all you need to know. But that's not what the Scriptures say. And that's not what the Spirit whispers in our ear. No. All Scripture is breathed out by God. All Scripture is theanoustos. We should know it all very well because it's the basis of faith. It's the basis of trust. So let us pray that the Lord will give us such understanding that we might be a people of faith and not of doubt, that we might not be a people wavering around like a sea, constantly in motion, wondering what's going on, but we'll be stable and fixed upon Him.